Okay, so this is a telescope which is perhaps a little bit further away from getting results than most of the ones we've heard about. This is, I'm going to tell you about a project which we're trying to get going in Cambridge at the moment called the ArcMinute Microkelvin Imager. The name of the telescope tells you all you need to know about what it does. I hope after various things that have been said today, no one needs any convincing about the desirability of doing SED surveys over a reasonable range of sky coverage and sensitivity. So just to recap a few things which I'm sure everyone's terribly familiar with. The SED effect being independent of redshift, one of the many ways you can think about this is that the 1 plus z to the 4th dimming of surface brightness, the expansion is cancelled out by the 1 plus z to the plus 4th dependence of the energy density of the CMB, which is the thing that tells you the energy change in a quantum scattering. And the total SZ flux from a cluster, so the delta T along a line of sight is the integral of the pressure along the line of sight. And so if you integrate the delta T over the solid angle of the cluster, and so that's the total flux density you see, that goes as the integral of the pressure over the volume of the cluster, and so that's the total thermal energy content of the gas. And it doesn't matter how the N and the T are distributed. So if you're looking at the whole flux of the cluster, we don't care about things like temperature, substructure, and how exactly the gas is distributed. We're learning some useful bit of physics about the cluster itself. And, of course, so things that energy content comes from gravity. If we neglect injection from stars and supernovae, which is a good approximation for massive clusters, we can hope to select clusters by mass. And so that tells us about interesting things like the amount of matter, the baryon fraction, amplitude of the overall fluctuations. And this is actually nicely complementary to other kinds of surveys you can do. I'll switch to the next overhead has the same X-ray picture. You haven't missed anything. So if you compare, this is some simulations of what you might see with an XMM, kind of medium deep survey. These are for a couple of different cosmologies. These simulations were made up by Vinczyk and are pressure sector distributions of clusters, but each cluster is a numerical simulation. And you see that in the X-rays, you're looking mostly at the lower redshift clusters, and think that's what the simulations are normalized to. The two pictures look pretty much the same in two different cosmologies. If you look at the SZ of the same simulations, then you see that in the low omega universe, this isn't noise, but these are noiseless simulations. All this little faint stuff is all the faint clusters that just don't exist in this. And so, that is very well known, both the source counts and the redshift distributions of clusters are very strongly cosmology dependent. And also strongly dependent on the numbers like the baryon fraction. And because the X-rays and the SZ depend on different things, as with the Hubble constant determination, SZ surveys and X-ray observations of the same clusters allow you to break the verity genesis, measure the cosmology, and measure the gas fractions, and generally learn about evolution of structure. So what we really want is a cluster survey which goes to really high Z, so we can look at the evolution of these clusters, which we'd be able to do with all kinds of follow-up points observations with big optical telescopes, X-rays, lensing also you'd want to do on your clusters that you find in such a survey. So there's lots of exciting things to do. How can we actually do it? Well, at the moment, the state of SZ astronomy is that we can more or less routinely do observations of known X-ray or optically or otherwise selected clusters. There are a few groups that are around the world doing this, and so we can learn some interesting things, H-naughts and so on. We have indeed proved, if anyone had any doubt, that the MB comes from at least a register of 0.8. There's still a few people out there talking about iron filings. The problem is that our sensitivity and sky coverage at the moment is really not good enough to do a survey. We're looking at huge clusters, these great big things, all at moderately low redshift, up to 0.8. Most of them are lower than that, up to 0.5. And so we need this blind SZ survey. So what do we need to think about in designing a survey telescope? Well, there's a whole bunch of things to worry about. The atmosphere, the foregrounds, the various kinds of systematics, and who's going to pay for it. So if you're thinking about total power type measurements, you worry about your sensitivity isn't really a problem for all these wonderful barometers, and stability doesn't seem to be much of a problem either with the new barometer systems. The atmosphere is more of a worry, but if you can build a nice big array receiver, then you can look at the correlations between adjacent pixels. You can get around spillover problems by doing drift scans, and to get the good resolution, the kind of arc-minute resolution you need to put your array receiver on a fairly big antenna. As we've heard earlier on, there are plans to do just these things. I'm going to concentrate on what I know about, interferometers. Here, stability is not so much of a problem because we correlate the signals from two different antennas, and usually the only thing that's common to the two antennas is the actual signal from the sky that's coming from where you're looking at, so we don't have to worry about atmospheric correlation, receiver correlations, and so on. We have a diagonal noise covariance matrix. That's the way I like to think about it. We get around various sort of systematics by various interferometer effects I mentioned the other day. The problems are that we don't want to resolve out these clusters, which means we need small antennas with short baselines, and we would like to make high quality images with good sensitivity, which means we need a well filled aperture, which means we need lots of small antennas with short baselines. And the interferometers typically work at frequencies where foreground sources are your main contamination, and so you need simultaneous long baselines to solve the source contamination problem. But just to emphasize that the short baseline question is really important, here is a picture of the Fourier transform of a cluster. So this is what you would measure with an interferometer, flux density against baseline. And at the moment with the Ryle, for example, we have a shortest baseline around about here, and we're sort of measuring fluxes down here, and the interesting number that we want, the total flux of the cluster, the thing that's proportional to the mass, is this number here. Of course, it's a bit of an extrapolation from there to there. But if you're doing a survey and all you care about is counting clusters, then what you care about is simply signal to noise of your detection. So if we're just worried about detecting these things, of course, the time to get to a given sensitivity goes as the one of the signal-to-noise squared. So with the same flux sensitivity, if you can go from that point on the curve to that point on the curve, where the signal is 10 times higher, you can do it in 100 times less time. So if we can persuade our interferometer to measure this point instead, we can survey 100 times quicker. we haven't changed the error bar, all we've done is change the baseline from 600 lambda to 200 lambda. So clearly is an important thing to do. So our solution designed for this telescope is to build an array of 3.7 meter antennas working at in the 12 to 18 gigahertz band, which is where the Ryle telescope works at the moment. I'll explain why that's a good idea in a moment. To up the bandwidth, the current Ryle has bandwidths of 0.35 gigahertz, which was exciting at the time, but is rather poor now. Bandwidths of the telescopes we've been building has been sort of steadily going up sort of exponentially over the years, so it's time to get to about 6 gigahertz now. If we can build 10 of these antennas, which gives us 45 baselines, that will give us a very well-filled aperture in the important regime of baselines. And the important foreground here is radio sources. But if we do the same upgrade to the Ryle telescope, which has five 13-meter antennas, which is lots of collecting area, we give it the same high-bandwidth correlator and also improve the receiver somewhat, then we've got easily enough sensitivity to take care of the point sources. And the interesting number at the bottom is what this will cost to do. So it's about £1 million. I gave this talk in Toulouse, so substitute dollars for euros. Same thing. Okay, so this is what the telescope does and will look like. So this is a real telescope, Ryle. This is an imaginary telescope. Little farm of 3.7 meter antennas inside a ground shield. We have a nice building waiting to be the control room. So you might be wondering, what on earth are we doing at 12 to 18 gigahertz? I mean, nobody does CMB observations at 12 to 18 gigahertz. And the relevant questions look to us like this. If the two things you care about are your sensitivity and your foreground, what determines mostly what you see. If you plot the temperature of the sky plus the temperature of your receiver, and this is assuming sort of canonical number of about half a K per gigahertz for a Hempt amplifier, then you end up with, for a completely dry atmosphere, this is the total temperature, system temperature you get. And if you add water to the atmosphere, if you add 2 millimeters of water for a decent site, you do that. If you add 20 millimeters of water, which is more typical for Cambridge, then you get to see something like this, and there it's kind of gone off scale, the atmosphere is opaque. So here are some popular observing bounds, 12 to 13. 12 to 18, 26 to 36, and big band around 90. And if you compare then the system temperature divided by the square root of the bandwidth, which gives you your kind of raw sensitivity, then you find that, so this is comparing 12 to 18 at a wet site with 26 to 36 at a moderately dry site. They're about the same sort of raw sensitivity. Of course, it's a bit unfair to put a 90 gigahertz telescope at sea level. So if you take it up to 4,000 meters, the whole thing scales down a bit. And again, that's comparable. So in kind of raw sensitivity, there's not much to choose between each of those bands. If you look at the signal you're looking for, there's a blade. So So this axis on the left is now micro K. So that's the delta T from a big cluster, 10 to 15 solar mass cluster, and there's 10 times smaller. Signal, this is dropping off as you're heading up towards the thermal SZ null. And so you're now losing a bit of signal to noise at high frequency because the SNR effect is a bit fainter. But what really makes a difference is the confusion noise from sources. Now, above about this frequency, or maybe this frequency, this curve is not at all well known. There are very few measurements, but this is a kind of best guess extrapolation. Clearly, at low frequencies, although you get fantastic raw sensitivity down here because you can get incredibly low temperature, system temperatures, you're just seeing sources. And the way to kind of put that into perspective is to overlay these two and compare the signal from a cluster with the confusion noise. And you see that down here at lowest frequencies, the signal from the sources is comparable with the signal from a bright cluster. You do nothing about it. Up here at higher frequencies, then you see bright clusters, but you're not going to be able to see the 10 times fainter clusters, the 10 to the 14 solar mass clusters, unless you do something about the sources. So you can't necessarily go very deep at any frequency without worrying a bit about the source confusion. And basically what it comes down to is if you're starting from scratch, you probably want to build a telescope at 30 gigahertz to do this. We're not starting from scratch. We've got the Royal Telescope, which is very big, expensive antennas. Would cost a lot of money to build something with comparable collecting area. We've already got it. It was paid for 30 years ago. So given that we have this huge collecting area available to us, which allows us to do the source confusion, and also allows us to stay at home, we can. It's 8 kilometres down the road from the lab, and we can look after it without any worries about working on remote sites. So that's what we plan to do. Of course, the way we cope with sources is, again, if you look at the Fourier transform of a cluster and the Fourier transform of a point source, they're quite distinct. And so you have baselines in here to measure the SZ, enough baselines out here to measure this accurately enough that you can subtract it from down here, and you're okay. So with a reasonably good bandwidth and an advantage, apart from just the straightforward sensitivity you get, is that it makes your UV coverage a lot better. So this is the UV coverage we would get from an array of 10 antennas splitting our 6 gigahertz of bandwidth into 1 gigahertz chunks. As you can see, this is essentially fully filled from this minimum radius, which is our antenna size. The reason we have 10 antennas of this size is that this UV coverage that we get from the array of small antennas then couples nicely onto the UV coverage. This is the shortest baseline of the existing Ryle antennas. So we get essentially continuous UV coverage from angular scales here corresponding to about 10 arc minutes to way out here, which is sort of 30 arc seconds or so. And just for those of you who are still not completely at home in the Fourier plane, if you imagine what a cluster looks like in real space, I was bored when I drew this slide. So here's a typical cluster extended over a few arc minutes in real space, slightly extended north-south. You Fourier transform that. This is reasonably well to scale, despite being hand-drawn. Then you get something extended east-west now, with a typical size of a few hundred lambda in the UV plane. And if you put that on top, then you see that you are measuring everything where the signal actually is, rather than measuring out here, which is what we're doing at the moment. Okay, so what do we get in terms of sensitivity? This now, before people start having heart attacks, let me explain what some of these lines mean. These are not all power spectra. The purple. Sorry? Let me explain. Okay, so this is a power spectrum. Power spectrum of the DMB. You want to know about that. This is the current sensitivity of the Ryle telescope, expressed in micro K per unit L space coverage. And this is what the sensitivity of AMI will be. So a large factor lower and going out to slightly larger angular scales. This red curve, labelled SZ, is the signal from an individual cluster that you're looking straight at, not averaged over the whole sky. And this is a kind of 10 to the 14 solar mass cluster, which is why we can't detect it at the moment, below our current sensitivity, but it's way above the sensitivity of AMI. This thing labelled strings is also not and a completely insane guess at the string power spectrum, but what you would see if there was a string on the sky and you were looking straight at it. So this was got just by taking one of François Pluchet's string simulations and doing a mock observation of it. I picked a random portion of it, and there just happened to be a bit of string in the field. Now clearly, yeah, there isn't a bit of string in every field in the sky, and of course nobody has any idea whether there's one string per couple of fields, anything down to zero. But if there is one and you look at it, we can see it with huge signal to noise. Whatever the typical mass unit length of the strings in Boucher simulation was, whatever the canonical number is supposed to be, I never remember. Oh, those are ruled out as explanations of structure. But somebody can correct me if I'm wrong. But the kind of mass unit length of a string comes out of the particle theories, and the only question is how many of them there are. I mean, is it zero? Is it a few? It's probably not a skyfall. Yeah, okay, this is a power spectrum, because I couldn't find any actual pictures of the Ostreicher-Vishniac effect from anyone who's simulated it. So again, this is a power spectrum of a non-Gaussian thing, and so typically it's might be a bit easier to see. I have to say this is the highest prediction of the Ostreicher-Vishniac effect I could find. It has all the realization parameters just neatly tuned. But again, if those are the right parameters, then it's a long way above our sensitivity. Yeah. That's for the Ryle telescope observing for 6 months, but spread over the same field of view. So this is what you get if you point AMI at one field for 6 months, and if you point to make the comparison fair, if you point the Ryle with you divide the 6 months into the number of pointings you need to cover the same field. That's the Ryle as it is now. Yeah. The sensitivity will go up by a factor of about 5 or 6 or something. But the Ryle upgraded is an intrinsic part of AMI. In fact, yes, the Ryle upgraded is this part of the line. Okay, and then the array of 3.7 meter antennas is the continuation of the line to the lower L. So, in terms of the cluster survey, here are some pretty pictures. We wanted to convince ourselves that we would see something even in kind of worst case scenario. You know, we didn't want to build this thing and then look at the sky and see nothing. So we've put into our simulations rather pessimistic assumptions, like, I can't remember the exact numbers, but fairly low low-end estimates for the baryon fraction and sigma 8. So these numbers probably don't agree very well with Joe Moore's numbers, because I think he's got something slightly more realistic. So in real life, we would hope to see a lot more of these. Can you remember? I didn't actually do this bit of simulations. I remember the baryon fraction is 0.1 and sigma 8 is, can't remember, does 0.8 make sense? I'm not sure. These things were done by Vincek and Rudy Neisel, and I'm afraid I haven't got my numbers written down here, so I've not perjured myself by guessing them. They're certainly on the low side. What this turns out in terms of looking at source counts, these are the number of sources for a given observed flux with AMI as a function of frequency on the sky. And so we can plot our sensitivity as a straight line of slope minus 2 on here. So this just tells you if you do a survey with in the specified amounts of time down to a fixed flux limit, which is the same as a fixed sky area, the ratio of these two lines tells you how many sources you see. And of course, interestingly here, it turns out that these source counts have a slope of about minus 2 as well. So it doesn't matter whether you do a deep survey or a shallow survey, you see the same number of clusters. But of course, given all the things that we know about other selection effects to do with deep and shallow surveys, you know, obviously you're selecting at a different mass cut. What we would do in practice is do several surveys. We'd do a deep survey and a shallow survey and probably a medium survey. And of course, the other boring thing you can do is look at nearby well-known clusters. So say at the moment we are resolving out 90% of the flux in the clusters that we look at. Here's an actual Ryle observation. This is Abel 1914. And here is a simulated AMI observation of the same cluster on the same scale. And so with this amount of signal to noise and resolution and level of detail, plus all the wonderful X-ray lensing information you'd have on these redshift 0.2 type clusters, you can do a fantastic job of, you know, sorting out the physics of what's actually going on in these things, looking at the baryon distributions. You could even think about getting sort of bulk motions within the cluster, all kinds of great things. And this is all completely technically feasible to do. We know exactly how to build the telescope. There are no problems to be solved apart from getting hold of cash. All right. We'll build it in Cambridge. I mean, the atmosphere in Cambridge is fine at 15 gigahertz. There's no correlated emission, there's no significant tropospheric phase fluctuations even on the baselines we're interested in, and the opacity is really quite low. So there's given that we're in this band, there's no reason not to build it in Cambridge and save ourselves the hassle of having to fly to the telescope. Yeah, I mean, we can upgrade the sensitivity of the Royal Telescope as much as we like, but we're never going to be able to get the antennas closer together than their diameter, not without a nasty accident. No. I mean, the reason for not wanting to miss a chunk in L is that partly it's because where we are at the moment. Speak of random transparency. So at the moment we're sort of here, just where the signal's starting to climb up. So we want to get sort of from here onwards, just to get all the signal. Well, we can't use the mile at 30 gigahertz.
That's what I wanted. Why not?
Okay, because the atmosphere in Cambridge isn't good enough at 30 gigahertz. The opacity goes up very quickly. Once you go over the 20 gigahertz waterline for that other plot I showed, the atmosphere is terrible at 30 gigahertz in Cambridge. It was attempted many years ago. It went in the 5 kilometer telescope as it was then. They attempted to run at 30 gigahertz. I think they detected Cas A. About 10%. You could tune that depending on exactly what you wanted to do. If you're just out to detect clusters not in a regime where you're going to be confusion limited, you would just shove all the antennas as close together as you possibly could. So you'd crowd all the sensitivity down here. You'd have a synthesized beam of 5 arc minutes or something. And you'd make lousy images, but you'd have to go at detecting everything. Or you can pull things out and go to a beam size of 2 arc minutes or 1 arc minute. Make a high-resolution image, if that's what you want to do. Doug? No, the funding status is that we applied once to JIF, if anybody knows what that means, the Joint Infrastructure Fund, and got turned down. And we haven't applied again, but we're about to soon, to just the standard PPARP funding. Yeah. How much money? About £1 million, $1.6 million. We are funded to the extent that we have all the people to do this. So it's just capital is what we need. Yeah. I'd hope to have the Ryle part of it going quite quickly because we've got all the antennas and everything in place. The whole thing finished in 2 years or something. I mean, we are doing prototyping and hardware development and so on at the moment, because that doesn't cost much.